Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HR Latte, your first cup of talent management whipped to perfection.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to HR Latte. It is a beautiful morning, very early on the West Coast. I am actually coming to you live from Pacific Grove, which is just north of Monterey and just north of Carmel and just south of Monterey, enjoying a quick break before I get back into the swing of work. It's spring break in my area, and I'm enjoying some time away, but I could not leave HR Latte just floating out there, and I have a terrific guest this morning. Michael Vandervoort is my guest, and he is going to help me kick off my April series of Positivity at Work. Michael, thank you for joining me this morning.
Morning, Rand. Thanks for having me. Really nice to be on a podcast with you. So good morning. It's a little bit foggy here in the mountains in Georgia, but it's also a nice day. We've hit spring and flowers are blooming, so it's all good here too.
I am very happy to hear that. I know it's been a rough winter for many folks on the East Coast in the Midwest, so it's nice to hear that and see the pictures everywhere that spring is actually happening, other than in New York, when I think they got a snowstorm yesterday, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, New York, that story unto itself. We'll leave them out of it. They don't deserve much more beating this year.
Oh, that's not true. That's not true. Big shout out to all of our friends and fans in New York. So Michael is an HR practitioner for a very long time, for over 25 years, who has specialized in helping companies and clients build thriving workplaces driven by positive employee relations. Michael, tell us a little bit about what that means.
Well, you know, so I guess in the HR space online, I'm known as the labor relations guy. But truthfully, I've worked as a practitioner for nearly 30 years, which always makes me, you know, kind of go, oh man, I'm getting old. But it's been great because over the years of my career, what I've had an amazing chance to do is to work with some really great organizations. And I think if there's one lesson I carried away from all of that, it is that, you know, great workplaces are the key to how you treat your people, how the culture, and I know we talk about culture and engagement and all these buzzwords, but truly the culture that you build, the base values of the organization drive the success of an organization. And if you have good values and you hold true to them, it seems as if the companies that I've worked for that have practiced that simple philosophy have achieved greatness in, you know, customer service, HR practices, and profitability. And what I try to do today is to help employers that are members of the group that I am the executive director of now, build those practices, build those kind of cultures, and create workplaces where employees can thrive together.
Great. And that leads us to my first big question, which is, tell us about your new job, Q Inc., and what that entails. I know you have a great event coming up, so please fill us in.
Sure. So for the last 7 or 8 years, I worked in Florida at a company called Publix Supermarkets, which is not on the West Coast, but which is really a beloved brand in the southeastern part of the United States. They do business in 6 states. They're company-owned. They're the largest employer in Florida. They've been on the Great Place to Work list every year since that list was created. People rave about our customer service. I mean, you know, so I was in a really great place. I was their manager of labor relations. We did tons of good work. We had really good employees, which we called associates because we all had skin in the game. We were all owners in the company. It's one of the largest employee-owned companies in the United States. And
wow.
I left that because I had an opportunity to join this organization called Q Inc., C-U-E Inc. Our website is cueinc.com. And this organization exists. We actually, our tagline for the organization is Inc., an organization for positive employee relations. And what we do is we work with member companies, companies who join the organization, to share best practices in building positive workplace cultures. And we provide a variety of programming and educational opportunities to help companies who want to build great workplaces and be good employers do that in a way in which they can share that information and network with each other throughout the year. We have two conferences, which are kind of our mainstay events. We do one conference in the spring, and we do another in the fall. And the one you mentioned, Ryan, is coming up in Louisville, Kentucky, April 26th to the 28th. And we have a great lineup of labor and employee relations focused learning opportunities. This is probably the only negative piece of news I'll bring up. The National Labor Relations Board has been very active over the last couple of years, and they've issued a lot of case decisions, and they've engaged in a variety of rulemaking, which is substantially changing the way labor law and policy affects employers in the United States. And some of their most recent and most sweeping changes in the rules are taking effect on April 14th, and our conference is on April 26th. So we have a whole series of workshops and concurrent sessions related to educating employers about those changes. It's not like the changes will, you know, just change everything overnight, but if you get involved in anything related to the National Labor Relations Board, you're definitely going to want to understand those changes and how they could affect you. And that's true whether you're a company with unions or a company without unions. So we're getting a lot of interest in this conference, and registration is very high. But that's good. That means that people in HR are paying attention to the issues that are coming their way, and they're, you know, even if it's a little late to the game, they're getting in the game and coming to try to learn. So there have been a ton of law firms sharing webinars and workshops around this topic. But we're going to have Paul Hebert, who I know is a former guest on your show. He's going to be speaking one day on everything you wanted to know about influence, but we're afraid to ask. We'll have a National Labor Relations Board member there to help educate us. We will have a global HR expert from HRPA, and a number of other workshops. It's going to be a really great event. You can check it out at our conference page at qinc.com. So thanks for the opportunity to mention the conference, Randy.
Perfect. Perfect. So if they go to qinc.com and there's a tab that says conference, they can just click there and find out more information?
Right in the middle of the homepage, it says conferences and register here.
Great. Great. And I know that we can follow you on Twitter at Q Inc. That is C-U-E-I-N-C to learn more. And Michael's very active on social media. Also, a recent co-host, correct? To Drive Through Retail.
It's actually Q Inc. S-A. Q-U-E-I-N-C-S-A. Yeah, I couldn't get the other one. Somebody else already had it. There's a lot of Q Inc. out there, oddly enough. So Q Inc. S-A, and you can also find me at Mike Vandervoort for my personal Twitter account.
Sure.
Sorry, okay. What was your other question?
I said, and you're a recent addition to Drive Through HR, the host there.
I am. Since February the 14th, we launched a new team on Valentine's Day. It's Nisha and William, who have been with the show for a long time. And then Crystal Miller and I were privileged to be asked to join as co-hosts. And so we have four people now on our own blog talk radio show, Drive Through HR. It's at 1 p.m. Eastern time every day, Monday through Friday, for 30 minutes. So I guess this is all promos for Mike all the time. But we have a wide variety of HR topics, from labor relations to social media to recruiting and talent branding. It's all over the map. And we do some theme shows like you're doing. We had an HR Horror Stories Week, and we had an HR Gets Lucky Week, and we have some others coming up. Thanks for letting me plug that too. I was a part of that.
Of course.
Thanks.
Of course. So as we jump into our topic of creating a positive workplace, this is a big question, and this is a big topic, right? And it affects every employee around the world. And to ask what it entails is kind of big. But if you can give us, you know, what does it really entail to create a positive workforce or a positive workplace?
And it's hard to lay out a full, I mean, that's probably like a week-long workshop for
absolutely.
A full plan, right? But for the companies that I've worked with in the last 15 years, it started with values. What were the core values of the organization? And two of those companies were founded by a family, and the family still held a major interest in the company, even though they had grown far. Are we still connected? I lost all sound.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry, it went dead on me. Sorry about that. But
that's
even
okay.
Though the companies were founded by families and the founders had created values, they'd morphed far beyond that in terms of size and scope. But they held to those original founding values, which were paraphrasing, I'm not going to repeat all the values, but treat your employees fairly, treat your customers great, be prudent financial with your money, run your company in a way that is going to allow you to stay profitable and build great products. And sort of like those building blocks, if you follow and obviously each culture has its own, but if you follow those sort of core values and develop your policies and develop your business over, both the companies that I'm referring to were founded in the 1920s or the 1930s, and they're leaders in their organization. And what they did was they grew and expanded and developed new products, or even in some cases changed markets. They held true to their culture and their tenants and their founders' beliefs. And in doing that, we're able to create organizations where employees, and this is the part I want to focus on more than customer service or profitability, where the employees saw career opportunities, where the employees felt respected and treated
right.
Treated with value by their managers, where the employees had opportunities to grow. The company HR practices, they set expectations that were clear. They used good selection processes to make sure that they hired people that fit the company culture and didn't just take anyone in and put them to work and try to, show square pegs and round holes. And while that sounds way oversimplified, it's building that environment where people can succeed and thrive that made those companies great. And it takes a lot of work to stay ahead of changing technologies and changing values. At Publix, for example, in some stores, we had five generations working in one store.
Wow.
It was amazing, really, to see it, and yet it worked. And that was because the managers knew how to manage. Publix invested a ton of training in the supervisors. They invested a ton of training in the development and recruiting of the employees that they selected. And, it meshed together in some magical way. And that's what the companies that are members of Q, of which there are about 300, they all have their own formula or recipe, but they all strive to go somewhere in sort of that general direction of building a company that has a mission, value driven, and is making their employees able to thrive and support the mission of the company.
Well, and there's a lot to be said for joining an organization like Q and keeping up with what's happening in the world of labor relations and the world of work. When you look at organizations that are struggling to maintain a company culture or build a company culture, what are some of the biggest barriers that you see?
Right now there are several retailers that, that's kind of the universe I came out of most recently. There are several retailers who are maybe struggling. One in Minnesota specifically that tried to enter Canada and did some things.
Right.
They were very much like what I just described, the company that was founded a long time ago. Great culture. They ran into some, they ran into some issues with expansion and growth. And I don't know the story behind that, but they faltered at some critical step. And part of it had to do with not meeting, from what I read in newspaper articles, it didn't meet the expectation of shoppers in Canada. And then they were hit with some other external crises, like a data breach that was beyond their control. But it all kind of, you know, they had a perfect storm, and so they stumbled. And now they're, you know, now they're facing things like layoffs, reductions in force, change in CEO. So, you know, a company that was really great in two years through a series of missteps. And I think that the companies that, you know, you have to be resilient and nimble enough to overcome those. And I believe they will. And, you know, if you look at some of the fast food chains right now, many of them are experiencing a lot of issues with wage equity, unions are after them with employee protests, and some are doing really well in terms of responding, and others not so much. And the difficulty is in deciding against the larger scope of what you're like if you're not as profitable, for example, it's harder to respond with money, right? So you have to respond with a different strategy, how you treat your people, and sometimes you just have to stumble on. And it's really it's situationally specific, I think, to the organization. But the hotspots are, I think, to try to stay away from as many of those danger points as you can by practicing that conservative financial, that prudent financial investment and that investment in your people all along, instead of sort of waiting until it's too late and you have to play catch up.
Wait, exactly. Waiting till it's too late. That's key. When we talk about company culture or a positive work experience, are there three or four things you can share with us that most organizations can expect once that has happened? Like once they've done this, right? The companies that you mentioned, or we can look back at your time at Publix. Once you've created this positive workplace, you know, a place that has been identified by the world as a great place to work, what was the result of that? What are the expectations that can be there for an organization that puts the effort into being a great place to work?
I think that, well, like I said, from the beginning, when someone, for example, we had Publix uses kiosks still to collect applications, even in today's day and age, right? And you'll see online people who say, why can't I apply on the internet, right? Why can't I do it? They don't really say, why can't I do it from my couch? But, you know, I'd rather do it off my phone. I'd rather do, you know. And you know, I don't know if this is a deliberate strategy, but there's something about, for that company, for that specific culture, there's something about a person being willing to get up and come in the store and take the time to fill out a fairly tedious application, see what the store looks like, experience the environment, get a chance to interact with our managers, perhaps if they have questions or whatever. You know, so in other words, it's first contact, right?
Yeah.
Like even before you're a candidate, how much effort are you willing to put in? You know, and it's not a big test, but it's a little test. And those that are willing to make that effort are the ones that probably have, you know, the better shot for success in the long run. And it kind of plays out from there. Publix uses some screening tests to determine organizational fit as part of the application process. And then from there, when you get hired in, right, onboarding is very, very strategic. You're inoculated into the culture from day one. Not only about what the expectations are, but what the opportunities for growth and success can yield. Your experience to the culture, they show videos of the founder, even though he's been deceased for nearly 20 years. And it's not a cult, it's a culture. It's a culture that aims people for success of the organization and for themselves. And if you're willing to put in the work, you know, you can literally grow. The interesting thing about a retail company, whether it's Publix or any of them, are actually multiple companies. There's the retail store. This is true for restaurants as well. There's the retail store, or like at, say, a pizza company, you know, there's the pizza delivery guy. But behind that are multiple verticals of manufacturing and distribution and information technology and HR and other, you know, they're much larger and broader in scope than most people think when you think of doing retail work. So there's a ton of opportunity there to explore, and you can really grow within that company and spend 20 years there and do three or four different things if you're motivated to do so.
Well, and you have a built-in filtering process right from the very beginning. If you're not willing to walk into the store, to work for the company, how are you going to know if you like the place? How are you going to know if you like, you know, the people, like the environment? I think it's a great idea. And it's so against everything that we say today. You know, make it easy for job seekers, make it easy for applicants, when we know that work isn't easy. So they need to show some type of motivation, right? So let's not make it easy. Let's make it the right thing for that particular organization.
Right, and it's not to make it difficult. It's just it is a filter, right?
Yeah.
And it's a test for that culture. That might not work for Google.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
Google, I mean, and that's the point I'm trying to make. There is no standard blueprint. You know, you have to your talent selection, your application process, all that stuff has to be developed around the people that you're looking for, and provide them entry into the organization in a way that will let them be successful from the initial contacts. And in that example I use from Publix, it works very well for them. I'm sure at some point they'll have to adapt, right? I mean, and we, you know, some of the corporate jobs you can apply online, but for stores and retail, it's still more old-fashioned way, because that's a face-to-face environment where you're expected to work face-to-face with customers all the time, all day long.
Absolutely.
So you have to kind of it's actually a critical job factor. And that's why it stays that way, as opposed to going to, you know, mobile apps or something like that.
Sure. So let's talk about talent attraction and employment branding. You know, we've been talking about culture and branding and all that entails, crossing the streams with marketing, right? Recruiting, crossing the streams with marketing for the last several years. So does talent attraction, is it the same thing as employment brand? How do they differ? And how can that lead into a better onboarding experience for the candidate that is chosen for the placement? How can great talent attraction, a great employment branding effort, change the experience for the placement?
I think from the perspective of our member companies, there's 300 different formulas for 300 different members or whatever it is on how they do talent branding. But what I would say is they want, and generally speaking, and I don't think this is rocket science by any means, Grant, I think that those companies work very hard to have themselves seen as employers of choice. They want people to, when they hear the name of their company, they want them to see them as an employer that is desirable and has opportunity. Some companies from time to time face challenges in that respect and yet still manage to attract people. But I think what talent branding does is it makes it easier to bring the right people to your doorstep. And then after that, it's, you know, some marketing, word of mouth, great place to work list. You know, there's the notion that
right.
You can be at Publix, for example, the notion that their big thing is you can be an owner. You can build wealth as an owner. You own skin in the game at the company, and there's tons of opportunity.
Sure.
Those are the two things that really bring people. You know, for Google, it's, you know, you're going to change the world, right? Make it a better place. And
right.
And each of those will attract a certain type of people. But from a positive work environment, it's not just getting them to the door. The employer has to deliver that experience. They have to maintain it, and they even have to have it be believed. I think when people have gone through the funnel and in some cases move on, right, it's that whole word of mouth, the glass door reviews, all of that kind of cumulative package. And that's where the marketing side comes in. I mean, they can run ads and, you know, have cool photos, but it's still, I think at the end of the day, it's still what people say to each other.
Yeah, that's the truth. You know, the word of mouth and the IRL experience, you know, the real life experience, not what you read in a magazine or see on television commercial or see online in all the various social media channels. I'm gonna do something here to you, Michael. I'm going to throw your words back at you and have you help us understand what you meant by this. Yeah, I've heard you say this once or twice. When trying to be a great employer, the best defense is a great offense. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, and that sort of ties into the labor and employee relations thing. And so there's an aspect of work. I mean, unions in the United States and other parts of the world have existed for years, and many employers have had unions for a long time. I've worked in organizations where we had very successful relationships with unions and were able to manage our business and be quite effective. Publix did not. Some of the other, you know, I guess in the last 15 years, most of the companies I worked with didn't have unions. And that wasn't necessarily by my choice. That was just the way things turned out. The point I was trying to make with what I said, Ray, about best defense is a great offense, is that if you want to manage your company, if the goal of your business as a management team is to manage your company in the most effective and nimble way to be able to adapt and change over time, then the less additional encumbrances you have in that relationship between yourself and your employees is probably going to allow you to do that in the most expedited way. I'm not being very articulate here. Companies need to manage their business in today's environment to be able to react very quickly to changes in technology, the marketplace, financing, employee desires, other things. If you have third parties, and a union is what I mean by a third party, you have to negotiate some of the changes, and it slows you down.
Sure.
We saw some of that in the auto industry a few years ago when GM and Chrysler had to be bailed out by the government. They had the unions for a long time, and the rules and work processes and contracts that were there became so cumbersome, and the cost structure became so burdensome that they had to revise everything. And it was done through bankruptcy proceedings and some government intervention and some other things. The company survived, and they're doing okay today. And now they're coming up right now in Detroit. The Big Three is coming up on a renewal of a labor agreement. And the UAW had a meeting a couple weeks ago. They're going to sit down. They're going to talk about wages. One of the things they did, for example, is they created a two-tier wage structure. Entry-level employees that come into Ford, Chrysler, not Ford, Chrysler and GM, are paid substantially less than what a long-term employee had been there is paid. And that creates something of a cultural divide. And it's an issue for the company. It's an issue for the employees, and it's also an issue for the union. And that's going to become a very contentious topic in collective bargaining. I mean, so those companies exist. Those companies are, as far as I know, profitable, and they're building very successful products. But they have that relationship that's going to cause contention in their organization that they have to work out. Take some other auto companies that don't have the UAW in the mix, and they're able to make decisions and implement stuff without that additional wrinkle. And that's what I mean by best offense. Best defense is a good offense. If you maintain a strong culture, if you treat your employees right, if you build your company around values and shepherding yourself towards success, you don't get the intervention of a third party, which then kind of creates more issues for you to deal with when things get tough. So you can be more effective and more nimble against your competition. That's kind of what I'm talking about. I hope that explains.
That's great, Michael. I really appreciate that explanation, and it makes perfect sense. So you spend a lot of time helping organizations figure out how to do it better. I want to ask you now personally, what do you do to make sure that you do the best job possible personally for your employer, for the work that you do, whether it's being a podcast host or it's being the executive director at Q or the work that you did with Publix? Can you share with us maybe a couple of different things that you do personally to make sure that you are pleasing your employer and those that you're working for?
I hope that I practice somewhat what I preach, what I just preached. I believe I have a strong set of personal values related to work. Some of that is just you have to be available whenever. I mean, it may be old-fashioned in today's ROWE work world. I'm flexible. I try to stay current on technology. I try to remain focused on the job. I am passionate. If I'm part of an organization that I believe in, I'm passionate about the mission of that organization, and so that I try to sustain those values in whatever way I can. But I also will not I will also not compromise, you know, ethics personal. I guess, you know, personal values. I mean, something, you know, that, I mean, I may be at odds with, you know, a company position on, I don't know, you know, how we provide benefits to employees or whatever. But that I mean, as long as it's within the law, and as long as they're not asking me to do illegal things, I'm very adherent to the company culture and the company needs. And so I think, you know, it's based on values, it's based on ethics, it's based on practicing travel, right? I mean, you know, if you can go out and order an expensive drink, or you can order dessert, or you can eat at a fancy restaurant, or you can choose to kind of just go to a small place. You can fly coach, or maybe, you know, maybe they'll let you bump up to first class. You know, choices where you save the company money over time add up for you and them. And it, so a lot of it's just simple things, following those basic cultural tenets. And but also staying on the cutting edge of the industry, staying on the cutting edge of the HR profession, trying to bring new thoughts to the company to make sure that we're out in front of issues. All those kind of things, right, I think, are the things I try to do.
Thank you, Michael. Look, a half an hour goes way too fast. Any last words?
Yeah, no.
Any last words of wisdom?
I think in your company, you know, as an HR practitioner, I mean, I always, you know, since I'm so focused on labor relations, be aware of the stuff with the NLRB, and I know most companies in the U.S. today don't deal with unions. Only less than 7% of the U.S. private sector workforce is unionized, and so sometimes it seems like it's a dying thing. But there's lots of labor law things happening out there that are very active, and every day encroaching more and more upon employers who don't have unions, largely under the auspices of the NLRB. So if you're an HR practitioner, keep your antenna up on that and follow it.
Sure.
Even if it's not the most interesting part of your work life. So that's my personal thing for HR. And otherwise, travel, go see the world, go see
the world.
Yeah.
And that brings us to my favorite part of the show, Michael. And this is I call this my selfish part, because it's totally for me to learn as much as I can about my guests, but also to open my eyes to some new things out there. This is the quick hit fave portion, and I ask each of my guests these four questions. And so what's your favorite food?
My favorite food is good Mexican food.
I was just in
San Antonio and had some Tex-Mex, so that was awesome this weekend.
And your favorite book?
You know, I read a lot of, I don't have a favorite book. I read all the time. I read a bunch of books. I live on my Kindle. My favorite thing to read is science fiction and actually Scandinavian mystery novels right now. So I read them prolifically, and sometimes I read more than one at a time. So I read for relaxation. It's how I kind of tune out from all the other noise and social media and stuff. So I read that stuff for relaxation and escapism.
So give me an example of a Scandinavian mystery novel.
I'm reading one right now called Midnight in Malmö, which is set Malmö is a city in Sweden, and it's the author, the name is unpronounceable, but it's a part of a series. I think there's five or six books, all starting with M in Malmö. So
okay.
So I'm reading that one right now. So yeah.
All right, and your favorite place on Earth?
My favorite
this could
place
be
on
a
Earth,
room
probably.
In your house or park by your home.
Yeah.
It could be anywhere.
No, it's the city of Amsterdam.
Ah.
I love Amsterdam because I'm Dutch, because when I go there, it's different enough from the United States that you know you're somewhere else. You know, it's a cultural blend like New York City, but everyone speaks English, so it's very convenient for someone like me who is not bilingual. So,
perfect. Well, I've never been to Amsterdam. I'll have to check it out. And your favorite thing to do?
Travel.
Anywhere?
I don't. Yeah, I mean, I've been, since I turned 45, I'm 57 now, since I turned 45, I hadn't left the United States except for Canada when I was 45. Since then, I've been to Central and South America, India, Europe, and some other places in the U.S. that I had not been. My goal is still to get to Australia, New Zealand, and Asia sometime in the next 5 years. So, yeah, anywhere.
Perfect. Michael, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for joining us and kicking off our series on positivity at work.
Thanks for having me, Rayanne. It was fun. Appreciate it.
I'll
talk to you
great,
again soon.
Great. Right. Fun. Talk soon. And folks, as we continue the series throughout the month of April, gosh, where did March go? We'll be talking to Kelly Long over at Rackspace. And also, I have a special guest, Lou Adler, will be joining us on HR Latte later in the month. And then Kelly Orchard, who is an executive coach, will be joining me at the end of the month where we talk about how to bring positivity to your leadership. It has been an absolute pleasure this morning. I hope you have a great day.